This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and perfect timing after yesterday's provincial budget, where one-third of the total went to health care initiatives, including, finally, $2 billion over 3 years for home care and nearly $550 million to help people get access to family doctors through increasing the number of family health teams. Now, something like 2.3 million Ontarians do not have a family doctor. And the news of this cash infusion comes just after we learned that 108 residency placements in family medicine have gone unfilled. So my main question is that given all the other evidence that doctors are not keen about going into family practice, will this money solve the problem? And I'd like to hear from the audience if you're having trouble getting a new family doctor or your thoughts on this. The number's 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto, Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret and former head of the BC Cancer Agency, and Dr. Amal Verma, staff physician in general internal medicine at St. Michael's Hospital. Hi, and thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Libby.
Hello.
Well, let's start with Dr. Naiman. So do you think that all this extra money for health teams, is that going to solve the problem?
The short answer is no. They announced further earlier funding to expand health teams earlier, and they said that was going to help. And family doctors really question how that's going to help, as the majority of family doctors do not work within a team. And that funding call was for new groups. And actually, there are some places around the province where their funding was not approved. So on a day-to-day basis, I think that further funding right now is not going to help. And as you mentioned, there is millions of people within the province who do not have access to primary care. And even within Toronto, it's currently at 500,000 people. And that number will go up to 700,000 within 2 years. And really, something needs to be done now about the crisis in primary care. And I think that this is really good, and it looks really good, the headline. But on a day-to-day level, it's really not going to help the family doctor who's working now and who's questioning whether or not they should continue within their practice.
Right. But what's the problem of working within a team? Doesn't that work well?
100%. A team works great. The problem is it's very hard, like, to get a team. So, like, there would be no way that in my office that we would be able to have a team and to hire people. There's this infrastructure of people, and the process to apply, you have to sort of be part of a larger organization. So unless they were going to take family doctors and allow them to go and to move their location and set up a clinic that has this interprofessional team, that I think would be great, and I think it would really help a lot with the burden. But just saying that they're going to fund doesn't help the new teams without being able to somehow shift where the current family doctors are working into this team. I really don't think is very helpful right now.
Dr. Verma, I think there are teams that are attached to St. Mike's where you work.
Yeah, absolutely. Our hospital has a large academic family health team program that delivers primary care to a large number of people in our catchment, as do many hospitals. Some have academic family health teams. Others have sort of non-academic hospitals have family health teams for sure. And there are family health teams that are not connected to specific hospitals as well. I think it is nice to see certainly the government's focus or recognition on team-based primary care. That's, you know, come a long way over the years through, I think, advocacy of a lot of researchers and evidence suggesting that that can be a very effective way of delivering primary care to people. I do think it's also nice to see investments to try to connect more people to primary care. But certainly it seems like this is a step in the right direction, but there's a lot of work to be done.
And Dr. Moore, just a few days ago or a week ago, we learned that 108 residency placements went unfilled, presumably because people don't want to go into family medicine. And then we have this. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, and you know, we've talked many times on this show about the challenges in primary care and lack of access for many people. You've just got to be careful when you look at data that you're getting an accurate reflection. One thing that has happened over the past few years because of this recognition of a shortage of primary care docs is they have been increasing the number of training positions in primary care, I think by about 5% a year. So this doesn't actually mean that there are less people training in primary care. It means actually there are more because they've opened up more slots. That said, you know, I was this way, and I'm sure the other people were. When I went into medical school, I really had no idea what specialty I wanted to do, and I made that decision based on my experiences through the 4 years of medical school. And I suspect most medical students are like that. So it is concerning that based on the fact that people are coming in with an open mind and family medicine at the end of their training is not viewed as one of the special, you know, one of the specialties that people are moving to do, does reflect the fact that our training systems, you know, the students are seeing what they see in family practice and they're saying, you know what, that's not for me. And you know, that is concerning. And I think Alicia's talked multiple times about the challenges in primary care. And I think that's what the medical students are seeing.
Yeah.
Other specialties.
We've also seen stats that even male doctors are cutting back, who are family doctors, are cutting back on their hours to get some kind of work-life balance. Also about family doctors working in specialties. And I know that a lot of them work in emergency medicine, and I know some emergency docs. And the thing about it is you've got a shift, and when you're done, you go home. Dr. Verma.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some very appealing aspects to all sorts of different kinds of practice. Now, every practice setting has its own pros and cons. You know, an emerge shift could be in the middle of the night, or you know, the types of acute issues you're dealing with might be very stressful in that specific moment. And so, you know, there's pros and cons of each practice setting in medicine, and they suit different lifestyles. I do think that there's a general trend, like the times are changing, right? So, you know, speaking as someone who's kind of in that in-between sort of almost millennial, maybe a bit older than millennial generation, you know, there was a time that the generation prior to me where, you know, physicians, many of whom were male, probably the predominant number who were male and who had partners who were at home and dealing with childcare, worked super long hours. And the times have really changed where, you know, maybe men want to take on more responsibilities at home, or just in general, people are looking for a different kind of work-life balance. And so when we look at how much healthcare one individual physician or other kind of health professionals is interested in providing, or how much we want to work, those things have changed as well. And I think, you know, that has to go into a little bit of the workload planning also.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think times have changed. Absolutely. And it might be the partners of those male doctors who are saying, you better pull some weight at home.
Rightfully so.
One of the things that I noticed when there was this talk of teams, they kind of enumerated the various specialties and professions involved, and they included nurse practitioners. But nothing that I saw involved getting nurse practitioners covered by OHIP. So does anyone know, is that kind of underway? What would the process be? Would it just be the government saying, okay, we're covering nurse practitioner visits, or is it a more complicated thing than that? Silence. Does anyone know?
My understanding, a little bit outside of my area for sure, but my understanding is it's a little complicated in the sense that it would involve thinking about what like a fee schedule or what a remuneration schedule for nurse practitioners would look like. And it's why in general there's they tend to operate under a salary hired by a specific healthcare organization that maybe is getting funding for patient care from other methods or you know, receiving care as part of a broader package of funding and then allocating some of that to the nurse practitioner. So in one sense, care delivered by nurse practitioners can be covered by OHIP in that patients aren't necessarily paying out of pocket for that care because it's coming from some other way of the you know, funding within our healthcare system. But they're not billing the OHIP insurance program directly on a sort of fee-for-service basis.
I think within the teams that the nurse practitioners' funding must be covered through the team funding, just how it would be for the pharmacist and the physio and the dietitian and the social worker who are part of the team. There's been a lot of controversy lately about nurse practitioners going and setting up clinics within the community, and that coverage is not covered by the government. It's excluded from the Canada Health Act, and so it's a loophole now. Well, people will say that it's a loophole, that in terms of now a nurse practitioner can go and just bill the patient directly for the services, even though it could be the same service that me as a family doctor is providing that I would be unable to charge the patient for. And I think that's because of this demand for access to care that does not exist right now. Because if I wanted to go and hire a nurse practitioner to work in my clinic, I would be paying a salary to the nurse practitioner. That is not generating, I'm not able to bill OHIP for the services that are provided by the nurse practitioner. So it's nurse practitioner-led clinics that are located within the community that are often being now organized by companies.
Now, would it be helpful to you if you had a nurse practitioner and could bill OHIP for that person's services? Would that take a lot of the pressure off?
It would take the pressure off, for sure. The problem is that, as I've mentioned in previous shows, is that our office is part of this capitation model where we get paid a yearly amount for people to be part of our roster. And as one of the requirements of this contract that we signed with the ministry is that I'm responsible for providing the care. So the government would need to change that aspect of the contract, because technically I would be in violation of the contract, because I would be having another practitioner providing care that I have signed a contract saying that I'm going to provide the care. But would it help me? For sure, because then I would be able to increase the roster of the patients that I would be able to see, and I'd be able to provide more care for more patients.
Okay, so Dr. Moore, it sounds like there's a lot of bureaucratic barriers to making the especially primary care system work better.
Well, as we've talked about on the show many times, this problem with family doctors took a long time, and there's a lot of bad decisions made, and so you're not going to get a quick solution. I think the nurse practitioner one that you raise is really interesting. You may remember about 2 months ago we talked about this, because in Alberta they are allowing nurse practitioners to bill. And interestingly, one of the groups that was most strongly against it was the Alberta Medical Association. And I think there was this concern that, in a sense, they'd be dipping into the same fee pool that the doctors would be dipping into. And so I think we do need a sustainable a funding model for nurse practitioners, expecting people like Elisa to actually hire them out of the money they're paid from OHIP is just not realistic. And the final thing I'd say is I was in the subway last week, and I'd be interested in Elisa's comments. They're actually advertising nurse practitioner clinics where you pay, I think, an annual fee of $450. You get rapid access to a nurse practitioner. And I'd be interested to know what sort of uptake there's been, because this at least does give people access to health care, even if they have to pay for it.
She was just talking about it. So they have enough money to advertise on the subway.
But I think that speaks to the demand side, is that, you know, people are desperate to have access to medical care. And obviously they prefer to see a family doctor and they prefer that it be free. But if that's not being provided, then people have to make alternate arrangements.
Well, exactly. And what you bring up, Malcolm, leads me to the next question for Dr. Verma. I mean, is there a problem with the professional associations kind of protecting their turf, like the OMA?
You know, historically, professional associations have served a specific role in our system, and it's worth, you know, just being clear about what that role is, that they are representatives of that profession. And so they're going to advocate for what they perceive to be advantageous or important for that profession. And oftentimes that's really aligned with what's good for the healthcare system, right? Oftentimes a thriving, healthy, sustainable health system is good for physicians or nurses or whatever the case may be, whichever professional association or union you're talking about. But sometimes the interests of that association are counter to what might be good for a good healthcare system. And, you know, in Canadian history, the story there is that, you know, physicians opposed were some of the original opponents of Medicare programs here and internationally, right? And getting them on board. And once you can get them on board and work together, those you can actually achieve really great change. So, you know, have we seen professional associations act counter to the interests of a health system? Certainly that's the case. They're advocating for their membership, as is, I think, a reasonable role for them to play. You just have to think about that in the context, obviously, of what their role is. But most of the time, I do think that the advocacy there is largely geared towards what would be good for the health system, because what's good for the health system is generally good for the practitioners in it.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Susan in Toronto. And hi, Susan.
Hi.
You're saying your mom is seeing a nurse practitioner.
Yes. So many, many, many years ago, maybe about 10, I had some elderly parents, and their family doctor was quite a while, and I couldn't get them on the bus. And there was a nurse practitioner-led clinic that opened up a couple years prior. So I called them up, and they were taking new patients, and I signed my parents on, totally covered by OHIP.
It was covered by OHIP?
Yep, totally covered. It's a nurse practitioner-led clinic. They actually even do home visits. So now my mother now, you know, gets home visits by them, because she's now 90 and she has Alzheimer's. And they have a dietitian in that nurse practitioner-led clinic. They have social worker. And everything is covered by OHIP. And it's a wonderful model. I would highly recommend it to anyone. We get great care from all of the nurse practitioners. I believe there's about 4 or 5 of them that are working within the clinic.
Well,
a nurse practitioner-led clinic model is wonderful.
Well, yeah, what's confusing is that, as far as we know, they're not covered by OHIP. But thank you for sharing that with us, Susan.
Yeah, maybe just to be clear on that point, Libby, I think that there is funding from the government that's not through, like, the billing directly to OHIP, right? So the government does fund nurse practitioner-led clinics, quite a large number of them, and they fund nurse practitioners in other kinds of roles, maybe just not through, like, those nurse practitioners billing the government directly, but they are paid for by the government.
Huh.
This might be a clinic that's in Northern Ontario.
Well, Susan was calling from Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are nurse practitioner funded clinics in the north, and I think it has to do in terms of there just being a shortage of doctors working, and so this is an option that exists. Now, just to comment on Susan's comments that she's very happy with the model. So if somebody came to see me, they wouldn't have access to these other healthcare practitioners. So that's something that is lacking. And also, one of the issues that family doctors have with nurse practitioner-led clinics that are funded by the government is that they, in terms of the roster size that they're required to have and the amount of salary that they get, it's often more than what would be considered for a family doctor. So there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger within the primary, within family doctors, in terms of nurse practitioners. And you're probably right. It's probably related to people, you know, have their job and they have a livelihood and they've invested a lot of time by going to medical school and residency and working. And I think people are afraid that parts of their job are being taken away and that it leads to more complex patients for us to see, but the cost of everything have gone up and the amount of funding that the government is paying does not sort of fit with the complexity that we're seeing, and that there has to be something done in terms of remuneration of family doctors in order to get people interested in providing comprehensive primary care. Because now I think the majority of family doctors who do graduate, they are going into other aspects of primary care, like you mentioned, the nurse department.
I want to turn to this money for home care. $2 billion over 3 years sounds great. With home care now, there's very limited access. People want to stay at home. And there's a big issue with bureaucracy. This government came into power promising to abolish LHINs. LHINs are not abolished. They changed their names. There are a lot of people working there. They never have contact with patients. I think there's a big problem with the culture of those. So how do we make sure that this home care money goes into the right place in home care, Dr. Moore?
Well, the reality, I mean, we all talk about bureaucracy like it's a bad thing and it often does inhibit change. The reality is that healthcare in Ontario, I think, is almost half the provincial budget. So you're talking about close to $100 billion. So to run a system like that, you're going to have a bureaucracy. You're going to have an organizational structure that allows healthcare to function. The problem is that if you keep changing that organizational structure, like provinces tend to do, you centralize, you regionalize, you get into LHINs, you get out of LHINs, that just creates an added layer of complexity to delivering healthcare that really isn't particularly helpful. And I think the challenge with home care has always been that it's not really an integrated system. And the Ontario Health Teams, rightly, or, you know, however they're functioning, are really an attempt to try and integrate primary care and home care into a, you know, a more integrated system, as opposed to having the hospitals over here, the doctors over here, home care over here. So I think, end of the day, we all think investing more in home care is something that we absolutely have to do as the population ages.
And Dr. Verma, you're at St. Mike's. If there was more home care, don't you think, or do you think, that would take the pressure off of some of your emergency ward and all kinds of other things that you face from the community?
Yeah, thanks. I agree, Libby. You know, one of the other things we saw in this budget was an investment in hospital capacity in a few ways, right? They've talked about increasing the number of hospital beds by about 3,000 over the next number of years. It's worth noting that investments in hospital capacity alone are really not going to solve the problem of emergency department wait times or people receiving healthcare in hallways. We do need these approaches to think about helping people live better, more independently at home. So improving home care, improving primary care, improving the access to long-term care. Like, all of those things are critically important for improving emergency department wait times, improving hospital experience for people, and making sure people are treated with dignity in appropriate rooms in hospitals. So I totally agree. And I do think I agree very much with what Dr. Moore said about the challenges in home care relate a lot to the fragmentation of healthcare delivery and different providers providing services in different regions, and how you coordinate all that is a real challenge. But so with these investments, it'll be very good to see, like, as with all of these investments in a budget, right? The proof and the experience of us on the ground working and using the healthcare system will really be how are these investments executed, right? What the truth will be in the details. I'll just make one last point to your point about administrative efficiency. We hear a lot of complaining about bureaucracy or administration in healthcare. You know, according to large international comparisons, you know, Canada actually is quite efficient in terms of how much gets spent on the administration of healthcare in our country. We spend, you know, 2 to 3% of our healthcare dollars actually administering the system, which, as Dr. Moore said, you need some degree of bureaucracy to actually deliver such a huge system. And that's actually quite efficient when we look at international comparisons. And so, you know, I don't think the problem is too much administration or bureaucracy. I do think it's a matter of coordinating our services and dealing with the fragmentation that has happened. And as Dr. Moore said, a number of sort of historical bad decisions that led to this challenge in all the different sectors of healthcare.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. I want to go around very quickly and ask for a grade for the healthcare portion of last evening's budget. Dr. Naaman, start with you.
B.
Okay. Dr. Moore?
I honestly can't give it a grade because there's not enough detail. They're putting more money in, but how strategic that is hard to tell.
Oh, okay. And Dr. Verma?
I'm going to take a sort of similar tact and just say sort of incomplete as a grade, which is that it remains to be seen what will happen. I will say that, look, this is a budget with a lot of expenditure and investment in a very difficult fiscal climate. And that's not an easy decision for governments to make, right? And especially conservative governments have to, you know, they often have a different kind of ideological lens or approach to these things. And this government has made investments in this difficult time. So I think it's worth noting that and then recognizing that it is incomplete. Let's see how these investments translate to improvements on the ground.
Okay, message to the health minister and the deputy ministers. You have some more homework to do for the panel. So I hope they hear that. In the meantime, thank you so much, Dr. Malcolm Moore, Dr. Elisa Naaman, and Dr. Amal Verma. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that terrible bridge collapse in Baltimore and what effect that may have on us here and whether it is a kind of cautionary tale for us here in Canada when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, six people are still missing and presumed dead after that tragic bridge collapse in Baltimore. And here at home, authorities are scrambling to reassure us that Canadian bridges are safe. And there's also the question of the impact of this closure, which will undoubtedly be closed for a long time on our supply chains. So it turns out that the Port of Baltimore handles more automobile freight than any other U.S. port, more than 750,000 vehicles in 2022, according to port data, as well as container and bulk cargo ranging from sugar to coal. I don't know how much of that comes to Canada. So the question is, what does it mean for you? And the numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Jim Bookbinder, a professor in the Department of Management Sciences and director of the Waterloo Management of Integrated Manufacturing Systems and Research Group at the University of Waterloo, and Rob Hanfield, Bank of America Professor of Supply Chain Management at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to you both. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let us begin with Jim Bookbinder. So the first thing that we heard basically all across the country is the various authorities saying, oh, don't worry, Canadian bridges are safe. They've got these, I don't know, rock islands near them, not to worry. Should we take their word for that?
Well, I think that's more a question to ask some civil engineering construction professors, but that's what I've heard, yes. I don't think the impact on Canada is going to be of that type, even if there should be you know, a serious incident like we had in Baltimore. The impact on Canada could be more in secondary effect of the supply chain.
Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. Rob Hanfield, there's been some talk that that particular bridge needed work or was old. What's your view of that?
Well, what I've heard is that the bridge itself was sound, but that the design of the bridge was such that you know, the major pier was hit, and it was, you know, really the design of these bridges is such that you knock on a major pier and the whole thing is going to collapse. They're all very interdependent on each other. And this was really a freak accident. There are actually diverters around the bridge to prevent ships from running into it. The ship in this case lost propulsion. They lost control of the ship. And it happened to go in at an angle that just hit that pier and was not diverted. So it was a freak accident, if anything. And so I don't think the bridge itself was unsound.
Back to Jim Bookbinder. So what could the impacts be on our supply chain? We've just seen that more automobile freight goes through that port than any other.
Yes, that's true in the U.S. Baltimore is a major importer of cars from Japan, and some of the major car companies have distribution centers near there. I think the impact might be that at one end of the bridge, at the north end of the bridge, there are distribution centers from Amazon and BMW. And so, you know, there might be a secondary effect on Canada from the fact that now everything will take a little longer, but the traffic that was on its way to Baltimore, the container ships, they will be diverted to other ports like Norfolk, Virginia, Savannah, Georgia, maybe, and this will all be sorted out, but the travel times for the containers to reach their destinations will be longer than they would have been otherwise.
What about the impact on supply chains in the U.S., Rob?
Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest exports from that port is coal. So certainly a lot of those coal shipments will have to be diverted to other bulk cargo ports, for instance, Port of Virginia, Norfolk, Port of New York, New Jersey, but also Port of Wilmington handles a lot of bulk cargo in North Carolina. The vehicles, what they call the Ro-Ro shipments, roll on, roll off. Those will have to be diverted to other ports that handle that kind of freight. It's a very specific way of handling that particular type of freight, so it may likely have to go to Charleston or Virginia as well. So we're going to see increased capacity usage at other ports. We don't anticipate major diversions, as Dr. Bookbinder said. Certainly some delays may be inevitable, but nothing that is earth-shattering, I think, in the short term at least.
Mm-hmm. And during the pandemic, we saw shortages of autos, new cars, and they've just started to ease. So is there going to be any impact there, Dr. Bookbinder?
Perhaps not, because I think in months the automakers have built up the inventory of vehicles at their dealerships, so it's a little better than it was at the low point of the pandemic. So no, I don't expect a big impact of that.
Okay, well, at least it looks like we won't be suffering on that end. Thank you so much, Dr. Jim Bookbinder and Dr. Rob Hanfield. I appreciate your time.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
Okay. We're taking another break. And when we come back, oh my, we are going to talk about bad roads and driving. The CAA is launching its annual Worst Roads campaign. I want to hear from you out there. What are the worst roads that you drive on? And boy, things just got worse this week with the closure of the Cardner. And only part of the closure is in effect now. That's not a pothole situation, but it is not making driving any more fun in and around the city. So let me give the numbers before we go to break and before we go to that segment. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we'll be back after the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Today, the CAA kicks off its annual Worst Roads campaign, where residents get to vote on which roads they feel are the worst, whether you're a driver, a cyclist, or a pedestrian. Now, according to the CAA, damage to vehicles from potholes can range from $500 to more than $2,000, with the average cost of repairs being as high as $850. So what are your thoughts about the worst roads? And let me add the worst driving experience. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. I know that a lot of people have a lot of thoughts on that particular question. And now I'm joined by Teresa DeFelice, Assistant Vice President, Government and Community Relations for the CAA in South Central Ontario. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm raring to hear what everybody's worst roads are.
Okay, well, you do this every year, and are you expecting to hear something different from last year?
No, I'm not expecting to hear something. Well, I mean, we never know which roads are actually going to make it to the top 10. There are often some repeat ones, but every year we see some change, and that is either because something's come off the list and something, you know, new has to come on, or sometimes we get communities doing grassroots efforts to corral all of the troops and get a road popped up on, and make it to that top 10.
Okay, well, I'm looking at last year's top 10 worst roads. Number one is Barton Street in Hamilton. So people in Hamilton, tell me if you think that is still the worst road. And Eglinton Avenue West always tops the list. And, of course, that is where the never-ending construction on the LRT is happening. And now you drive by and you see stations that really look finished, but they don't appear to be anywhere near opening. I mean, I know people who are joking around about whether this is going to happen in their lifetime. We also have Finch Avenue West and Steeles Avenue East, Teresa. I mean, why are these always coming up on the bad, bad lists?
Well, it was interesting because Steeles for many, many years was on the list and then finally came off the list when all of the municipalities involved, because Steeles is a very long major arterial throughout the GTA, and all the municipalities were having a bit of a conversation and Steeles was wrapped up in it, and it finally got fixed. But, you know, the surface does have I'll call it a lifespan, a road lifespan. And so, you know, now it's starting to show a little bit of its wear and tear again, and it's popping back up on the list. So, you know, it does happen from time to time that roads that have come off the list come back on. And some of these other ones are really connected to major transit infrastructure projects, right? So then you feel everything. You feel not just what the construction and the congestion pain, but it's also the fact that the road's getting pretty beat up as a lot of vehicles are heading through there with materials.
Now, Dufferin was for many years at the top of the list, and I don't see it there last year. What good things happened on Dufferin? I occasionally take it. I'm trying to think if it was really better or a little better. What's the story on Dufferin?
Yeah, Dufferin, again, was one of those ones that was put on the list and many years ago after it kept appearing on the list. And a new mayor was elected in Toronto, they actually expedited the fixes on Dufferin Street in order to get it done. And, you know, I also travel Dufferin Street. And so in some parts, we're starting to see that wear and tear again. So it'll be interesting to see if people start bringing that one back into the conversation.
I want to give the numbers out again because people, I know voting has just opened, but you can put your vote on the air here. Tell us what you think the worst roads that you have to travel on are. The number is 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740. And we're talking about damage on the roads here, Teresa, but how does this play into all the construction? There's a big pile of construction very near where we are here in Liberty Village, and it's almost, I mean, I'm a little confused about the signs about where to go, because it almost looks like a you can't get there from here situation. But how does potholes and the problems created by potholes play into all this construction that seems to always be happening all at once?
Sure. I mean, what happens with that is, you know, obviously when a construction project is going on, they're not going to go and repave the road in the middle of that construction project. And sometimes those roads have to take a little longer. So, for instance, Eglinton Avenue East has come off the list, and it was on for a large duration when the majority of that transit project was really in that eastern portion. It's really the west section now that's still ongoing. But even in that time, like residents are saying, is okay, we get there's construction. Yeah, they may be voting on it, voting it forward because they want to see it on the list. But the city actually then did go fill in some potholes and try and make it a little bit better than it was. And so that is one of the challenges that people face. But the other thing to note about the CAA Worst Roads campaign is when you go to caaworstroads.com to nominate, you can nominate one road, more than one road. You have the option, whether you are a cyclist, a pedestrian, a driver. Predominantly people tell us it's about the road surface. But then we also hear complaints about congestion or lack of infrastructure like cycling or sidewalks cycling paths. So, you know, it really is open to whatever your pain point. If it's bad signage, poor traffic light timing, congestion, that is a bad road. If that's a bad road to you, it's causing you pain, then, you know, let us help you take your voice to government.
I mean, for instance, I'm not clear on what is going on. Suddenly, all this construction appeared on King Street West, not far from Dufferin, right here near Liberty Village. And again, wow, it's very difficult to discern what's going on. Do you know?
Off the top of my head, I don't. I know there's been a lot of construction in the core. And related to, and some of it is not roads. It could be sewers, or if there's a construction project like a building being done, sometimes they, you know, it takes its toll and spills over onto the roads. So it depends on exactly where it is. I'd have to go take a look at it, but off the top of my head, I'm not quite familiar with what's just happened. There's been a lot of construction down that way over the last years.
Well, yeah, this just popped up within the last week or so, and who knows what's going on with it. I also want to talk about the rehabilitation of the Gardner. So one of the lanes is closed this week, making the driving a bit of a nightmare, but now there's going to be more road closures, and it's going to go on for 3 years, Teresa.
So the Gardner is a perfect example of what happens when you don't maintain things on a regular basis. No different than your car. If you don't get regular oil changes, eventually, you know, the fact is the oil gets old and other parts of your car parts are going to deteriorate. The Gardner didn't have the right maintenance it needed for a number of years. It led to the city council making a decision as to the future of the Gardiner. And so part of this project now is a complete reconstruction of the eastern portion of the Gardiner. And I guess, you know, there's different ways to do it. And the choice that's been made is to reduce the Gardiner down to one lane each way and get that maintenance done. Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, people are willing to put up with a bit of, pain from construction because if they know the work is getting done, short-term patience. It's these longer, long-term projects that really start to cause frustration and spill over everywhere. And unfortunately, this is going to be one of them because the congestion, not just on the Gardiner, but on the surrounding area for people looking for alternate ways, whether or not to take the Gardiner or find different ways into the city, is going to be felt.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to hear from people who have started to feel that pain. Again, the number's 416-360-0740 and toll-free 1-866-740-4740. What's it been like this week with that closure? And I've always had questions about repeat closures because I live near Bathurst and St. Clair, and Bathurst gets a lot of construction repeatedly, and it's very hard to know what is going on. Also, DuPont, it's been dug up many, many times, and it's happening again. And we never know why or how, but there it is. Closures again on DuPont. Teresa, again, do you know about that?
I know that there's been several projects. I mean, you mentioned St. Clair. It's not just road, but, you know, the St. Clair streetcar right-of-way lanes are right now are closed with buses having to use the car lanes. And they've decided to just close that entire length in order to replace those streetcar tracks that now need to be replaced since their original installation. DuPont, is it at Bathurst that you're talking? I think that has to do with the infrastructure underground. And so, that's a big project too. The sewer ones are like, sewers take up a lot of space. And so, they're big round drums that have to be excavated. And so that's, I believe that project is a sewer main project.
Well, and I'm going to take a call from Jane in Toronto. Hi, Jane.
Yes, hi. This is about traffic, but it's the bike lanes that are perpetually causing a traffic jam from Royal York on. And, you know, I haven't seen one bike today go by there. I live on Bloor Street in a condominium, and it's insane. It's traffic. They're building a condominium just at Bloor and Jane. They've been working on the issue with the collapsed of the sewer pipe that Rotor broke through, and it's crazy. Like, there's a lot of us old people out here, and you know, I'm losing it.
Teresa, can you answer Jane about her particular problem there? Any insight?
It's an interesting perspective that you could bring to the Worst Roads campaign. We often hear one of the top four reasons the fourth reason is lack of cycling infrastructure. But we know that we do hear from members around how bike lanes they feel are contributing to some of the challenges on the roads that they're experiencing. And that's a valid reason. So you could take to the Worst Roads site and choose congestion as a concern and have your voice, and there's room to make comment to clarify as to why, what you think is causing it.
Jane?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jane, for that. We still have a few minutes left, and we could take some of your calls if you want to tell us about what your issue is. The number's 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And Teresa, you mentioned work on sewers. And again, in my neighborhood, I found out from people who are north of St. Clair, there was some work being done on the sewers, and it was toxic and people were getting headaches and all kinds of problems because of this work. Some of the material used on the sewers was toxic and they weren't informed in advance, but again, headaches and various aches because of this material. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. But, you know, I would always caution if you think or if people are experiencing that, there's a few things. There's your city councillor. There's
good
calling
luck,
311. At most construction sites or projects, depending on the project, there may be a number on signage around that project of like a project manager. But, I mean, that would be one where I would be calling the City Works Department or even public health.
That's a good suggestion. I'm going to take a call from Marek in High Park. Hello, Marek.
Oh, yes, Libby. Marek, yes. So listen, the bike lanes, I'm riding my bicycle. It's a nonsense on Bloor Street. And especially now when you have the gardener reduced and you have only one lane on Bloor Street instead of two or three lanes, it was original. So why don't we remove these obstacles? And by the way, I'm riding my bicycle. It's not safe because when the people are opening the door or coming out between the cars, you don't see them. So this is my proposal, is that let's get back to the Blue Street. The street should be street. And the bicycles, don't use the City of Toronto. Probably are not riding bicycles, you're going to work. They are going a different mode of transportation, so we have to be real, get to reality.
Okay, thank you for that. And Siham in Toronto. Hello, Siham.
Hello, how are you?
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I just want to echo one of the callers about Bloor Street. West on Lake Royal York in Etobicoke and little bit east and west until Islington, with the congestion on that part, and especially with, yes, the bike lanes on both sides of the road, as well as they're closing also a little bit further because of the restaurants. So the backup on Royal York is horrendous all the time. As well, I live on Lakeshore and Royal York on the south side, and we have two bike lanes, east-west, plus the lane for the cars and the streetcar or the bus. And it is a very, very dangerous thing to come out of a driveway and try to cross about four different lanes between pedestrians, cyclists, cars, and streetcar and buses.
Thank you very much for that. I'm looking at the clock. We're almost out of time. Teresa, again, tell us how people can vote. And we seem to have a lot of complaints about those bike lanes in Etobicoke.
Well, you know, it sounds like you have a very engaged listening audience. And you have until April 9th to vote for the roads that give you concern and for the various reasons that they give you a reason to vote. Go to www.caaworstroads.com and have your say.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that, Teresa DeFelice with the CAA. We'll talk again when the results are in. And we're out
of
time.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Bye bye. All righty. We're totally out of time. And have your say about the vote and tell us here what you're thinking. And that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.